This is April 12th, 1990, and I'm Bill Jones, and I'm interviewing James Franklin Condell for the second time. The previous interview, we had an opportunity to talk about basically his academic career, and of course, most specifically, the many years that he spent at Morehead State and the developments in the department and within the institution during that time. But Jim has had another career, a career in music, which has gone right along with, parallel with, the career in academia, occasionally the two overlapping. And I thought it would be useful to talk a little bit about that. And again, Jim, we'll give you a first shot. You've given me a very nice dossier here. Maybe you could hit the high points of just what your background in music has been.
Okay. I've obviously been thinking about this since we planned this
sure.
2 weeks ago, and felt that one of the things I may have to tell you, since this is a part of a long-term record, that I had to decide, and I guess today is a good day to decide as any, whether I ever really wanted to be a musician in
mm-hmm.
preference to some other things.
Mm-hmm.
And a good part of my life, people who've known me well have always said, didn't you really want to be a musician rather than a psychologist, and didn't this mean more to you, and things like this. And of course, I was always able to say, you said a career in music. I finally upgraded from a hobby to an avocation, particularly since I get paid fairly well for what I do in the level of which I
mm-hmm.
do it. But one of the reasons, excuses, rationalizations, whatever you want to call it, I said for a long time, had I put as much emphasis on music as I did in psychology, in fact, going all the way to the doctorate and that sort of thing, would I have been that competent and good? And I think the answer finally is yes. Knowing that I never would have been a great performer, or even anything more than an adequate performer. But at the time, I really should have been doing something about it when I had a GI Bill, came out of college, had a music mind and all that. I did not know that one could go into music history or musicology or music theory. I thought everybody had to be that great performer, and I didn't know that there were theorists who were acquainted with the instruments and can do things. But I've talked to a good number of people, including some of our faculty members here, who play other instruments. How much piano did you really play? Things like this. Enough to get by. Enough to get
mm-hmm.
by. They all say enough to get
mm-hmm.
by. I think as a theorist, I think all one needs to know is really enough to play keyboard, harmony, things like this, unless really one wants to get into this very much. I know voice professors who don't play piano, for example, and use the accompanists. And I've had an opportunity to, when I lived in New York, to meet a good number of people who made their school living, graduate school living, by playing in studios for voice
mm-hmm.
teachers and instrumental teachers, things like
mm-hmm.
that. So all this has come up. So I guess I can go back now and sort of pick up where I was now that I got that out of my system. Yeah, I probably would have liked to have been in music had I known, but I wouldn't want to have been in music at what some people call the eternal Holiday Inn circuit year
yeah.
in, year out, and that sort of thing. No, I would have wanted to do something like you have done and gone on to earn your degree and things like that. Even though you started off into administration and things like this, you still had this great background anytime you wanted to come back and teach your theory courses and things like this. I'm very fortunate. I grew up in a musical atmosphere. It was centered pretty much around the church. I came up through the Methodist Church, and we were what would be now the United Methodist Church, and it was the old Methodist Episcopal Church and then the Methodist Church.
Mm-hmm.
And we sang the hymns. We didn't sing the gospel tunes. We sang some spirituals in Sunday school and in our youth groups, but the worship service was about hymns.
Mm-hmm.
I never was in a church where you had a great choir. I didn't have the great choir until we got to college, and that was just fantastic, and I'll get to that a little later. So that sort of thing I knew about, and people started telling us about the beauty of music in church worship, and I'm very much in fact, about the last 10 or 15 years or so, I've been getting very involved in liturgical music with the guitar. That
mm-hmm.
is, now that many more people are playing the classical guitar well. There may become a day, 25, 30 years from now, when each town will have somebody who can play the guitar well, and there will be people who can play well. I've, you know, been over to Lutheran Church of Good Shepherd with Karen each summer. That has been something. And so I grew up with that. And then in this little town in Owensboro, Kentucky, the principal and his wife were extremely musical. His wife taught music and English in the high school. You know how you had to have these combinatory
sure.
things at the high school level. And she encouraged her children. They had four children. Encouraged all of them to be musical. And the father, the principal, whose father sang. And my aunt sang. Now, these weren't trained voices. They were just good voices. They had to have been trained. Who knows? But they liked it. One of our Sunday evening entertainments was going back and forth because we had pianos. They had a grand, we had an upright, and we'd have ice cream. The whole thing. Now this is 20s.
Make your own.
Mm-hmm. And then we'd play music. Mm-hmm. And Mrs. Ward, that was her name, Mrs. Ward would play, and we'd sing, and then her kids would sing and play, and we'd do. When I was a little older and knew a little more about what was going on, I had a cousin, I call her sister, but she was my cousin, older cousin. It was not. And this, you know Owensboro, so you know what kind of a prejudiced town this was and everything. But there was a white woman who taught music who wanted to experiment to see if a black kid could learn to play classical music. Well, okay, nowadays we would call that a subtle form of racism, but in those days, what the hell, who knew what to call it? So my aunt...
It was an opportunity.
Opportunity, yeah. So my aunt let her experiment with my cousin. My cousin became a fabulous pianist.
Hmm.
She didn't stay in music because she, like many others in those days, didn't know what to do with making a living out of music unless she went on and became a great player, and she... possibly could have. I know some other things now that she was much more socially inclined than she was self-disciplined to become a great
yeah.
performer. But she went to Hampton Institute for a year, and it was a private, well, you know, couldn't afford it. So we went to Tennessee State and finished her degree there and taught home economics in the high schools in Chicago for the rest of her life, but also always enjoyed the musical experience and taught her daughter, well, at least got her out to play. So I grew up in that atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the principal and his wife finally... gave up. They got out of music, and I talked to them much later when I lived in New York. They were friends of Fats Waller. They had come out of Cincinnati, and Fats used to have a program many years ago on WLW out of Cincinnati, which was a powerful, it was a 500,000 watt
yeah,
station, clear channel station in those days, and they played a night, an organ thing, and he encouraged them because of some friends who lived there in Newport and Covington, in that same Ward family, to develop a group of called the Southern Singers. And they gave up and went to New York and got on NBC and everything. But the star of the show was also a drunk. And they didn't last long. They just couldn't keep him off of the juice. So they settled in New York and did some wonderful things. There other kid learned to play. So I grew up in that. I had two older cousins who sang, again, not trained voices, but sang in a high school chorus.
Mm-hmm.
So there was always, I don't know when I wasn't, around
yeah,
music.
Important part of your life, that's
mm-hmm.
for sure.
And then when we had enough money to start buying radio, then I became an avid radio listener, and still am. I'll stay up half the night if something good is going
mm-hmm.
on radio. And so that was the early part of the attitudinal thing I will talk about in terms of music. So yeah, that was centered. Music was important. But more than that, growing up in that atmosphere, I also knew it was a great way for entertainment, to have fun. It was also a great way to spend all day in church, because that's what I had to do. I went to the Sunday school morning service, the afternoon, you know, the young people's things that I got older, and then the night service. That's when you used to have night things. And so I learned all the hymns, you know, not all, but, you know, what I call top 40, things
mm-hmm.
like this. The next level came when I went to live with my mother. I think I told you I'm from a broken home and that sort of thing, so they're divorced.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to live with my mother about 1929. This, of course, you know, is this crash, the end of the thing. My folks, aunts, really couldn't afford to keep me. They were going to move to Chicago and try to look for work. And my stepfather was not in our league. He was a nice guy. I'm not putting him down. But he hadn't gone to school. We figured he had about third or fourth education, but a nice old guy and everything. Mm-hmm. And he knew all the old heritage of the old spirituals and things like this. But my mother had been taught as a young girl to play music, and she had gone to college for 2 years at a little school called Walden University in Nashville, Tennessee, which was, again, a Methodist school. Hmm. It later was incorporated in... Meharry Medical College used to be a part of Walden University. But anyway, a lot of those old black church colleges had to fold during the 30s and whatnot.
Precarious.
Mm-hmm. So that was it, but she had a good musical background. And she could play the hymns mm-hmm. and a few other things. So she started giving me music lessons, and I went to this little one-room school, and the music teacher gave me music lessons. Now, they were 50 cents a week, but this is about 31, 32, like this. We just couldn't afford it. So I took 2 years of an old system. It was I can't tell you the name of it. It was a 10-volume system, and I do remember it was published by Theodore Presser. Mm. That's all I can tell you. Mm-hmm. But if you could ever think back of the name of this. But I finished those two books. And then somehow or another, I found out that I was blessed with a good ear. And I still, and this has been my problem all my life with music. I have a fantastic ear. And I could. So I started picking up things off the radio, playing them. As I started thinking about it, I even remember composing a couple of tunes. But I wrote it. Mm-hmm. And I could notate things like this. Mm-hmm. Well, in the old days, we had the Tencent store. And they had the... music woman who played behind there and would play songs. So, we'd go to town. That was a big thing, going to town. And so about once every 6 months, my mother and I would go to town and do some shopping. That meant we could spend about $2. that's how bad it was. You remember that.
Days.
A couple of times a year, she would buy me a piece of sheet music, and that was 35 cents. But she insisted 35 cents was a lot of money, so I had to learn these tunes.
Hmm.
So in the 30s, with all the radio listening thing, I knew the popular tunes, and so I would learn some of these things. Then I started picking them out by myself. I think I told you before, when I finished 8th grade, I had to make a choice whether I was going to Lincoln Institute or whether I was going to go to the city. So my mother wanted me to go to the city because she thought it was more opportunities, languages and all that sort of stuff, mm-hmm. which I did take. And I started hanging around the gym because I was such a support. As an athlete, I was so little in that, so I think the coach didn't really make me do all the fire stuff. I could sit around and play the piano, whatever I want to do. They just go over there, son, and get out of the way. And one day, a kid who used to be a junior high school, lived in that neighborhood, was walking to the gym on his way home from high school. He was skipping out. He came over to me and said, "Hey, I heard you can play the piano." And, I said, I took a few lessons, but I really don't know much. He says, "Well, I'm playing in all the bands now." And I think, how some of the young was doing. And I'm really beginning to make money now, going. So when you come down to high school, I will get you in the band, and maybe later on you can get some of the jobs I get. And of course, this sounded pretty good. Went home and told my folks, because I was living in Louisville with my cousin and my aunt, you don't want to do that. You don't want to play. Here comes the avalanche of negativism, which lasted for years. Mm-hmm. Lasted for years. You don't want to play that sinful music. You don't want to be playing out in those joints. You don't want to be doing this. Later on, my cousin, who worked in the registrar's office at Kentucky State, clerical kinds of thing, although she had a title, assistant registrar, what they kind of do. Said, okay, you want to do this, and we know you want to do it badly, and so you go ahead and do it. By this time I'm in high school. And so they started a second little band. They had an older group of seniors and juniors, so a bunch of sophomores, and we bought stock arrangements, and we had a little rehearsal. We had two gyms, a girls' gym. But finally, the principal heard about everything. He said, "Oh, we don't want that going on in the gym," and everything. And I thought, "Oh, what horrors!" But the drummer and the trumpet player had a very nice mother, had a nice little house down on 24th and Chestnut. She said, "Oh, you people can come down and rehearse at our house in the living room if you just keep it clean and stuff like this." So we started doing that. And so the time I was a junior in high school I finished high school at age 16. So when I was 14, I was playing. Dances.
Mm-hmm.
And I can always remember the first night we played on Percentage of Rain, I made 34 cents.
Mm.
That was the beginning. And then just started growing. And then sure enough, by the time I was a senior, this guy started getting me in other jobs. And I started playing with these old guys. I always like to tell this story. These old guys about 35, 40.
Mm-hmm.
But to a 15-year-old kid, these are old men. And start. I listened to radio, as I told you originally. I had a good ear. We didn't have a piano at our house, so I didn't get to practice. Didn't practice at all the whole time through high school. But I could go on a job and pick up these things. And these old men would pay me the same money they were getting to sort of sit there and play the accompaniment. And, of course, in those days, in the dances, you know, the rhythm section was pretty stiff kind of thing.
Yeah.
And played what you would call now accompaniment, a comping, you know, something.
Yeah.
And I played country clubs, hotels, dance clubs.
This is piano all the time.
Just piano all the time, piano. I know now, I didn't always know the names of composers. I know we were playing Irving Berlin and Cole Porter and George Gershwin. And I've had an affinity for these great standards all my life because of that experience. And so then by the time I got ready to go to college, I think I told you before, I wanted to go to Fisk. I thought that was a great school and everything. And my folks never told me that we didn't have that kind of money and stuff like this. And so they never talked about it. And finally just had to say, you know, you're going to Kentucky State. And I went up there with my cousin and they got a little money together. Well, they had a dance band at Kentucky State, Kentucky State Collegians. And it had a great piano player in it who had come down from Chicago. But he didn't want to stay. And he quit school in the middle of the year. And by this time, around the campus, they found out I could play a little piano, and so they gave me this music scholarship. And I never paid any more money to go to college. Yeah. And that's how I got through college. We had kind of enough to get through the freshman year, and I may have to go back to Louisville Municipal and stay home, but I didn't want to do that. And so that worked my way through. My friend, Walter Anderson, who had come down from Wilberforce, who had graduated from Oberlin. He taught at Wilberforce a year, and they hired him. I think Walter must have been about 24 at the most, and he was just fantastic. And, he was very nice, and he taught us harmony and counterpoint. Now, a harmony class had 4 or 5 people in it. Mm-hmm. Counterpoint had 2 people in it, music history, 2 or 3, things like this. Fantastic practice. But he told us we really didn't have the background. We didn't know how to play well. I took piano lessons from him for a year, but I just couldn't get Bach together. And he was a stickler because he'd come from Oberlin and, you know, 2-part, 3-part adventures. I couldn't get the right and left hand together. And then that September, later on, this guy, Jimmy Jones, whose father and my father had worked together at Le Moyne College in Tennessee, made him come back to school. He said, "You've got to get a college education." So he came back. But unfortunately, and this is the period of time now, this is the 30s now, they were going to punish Jimmy by making him, he knew how to play guitar, rhythm guitar, so they kept me on piano and made me, let me play the piano. But then after that year, they said, "Now you know Jimmy's a better piano player," and that sort of stuff. So, why don't you go home and see if you can pick up the guitar this summer. And I did, and the school bought me a little old Regal guitar, I think $19, $95, something like that. It wasn't much of a guitar, didn't it? But the little guy that I gave it on to my outfit, a guy named D. Wells. D. Wells had a little music studio at Shelby and Broadway in Louisville. So I went up to see D. Wells, and he wasn't sure. He had never had a colored student.
Yeah.
So, but he said, you know, maybe it's time I had one, but maybe I'll lose some of my white students if they find that you're coming, so could you come early in the morning? So he taught in the afternoons after lunch, so I would come at 10 o'clock. And so I took lessons all summer and learned fast how to make the basic chords, the sevenths, the ninths, the majors, the minors. But I didn't have all the sixes and the ninths and the thirteenths and all the things that you do now, but just real nice basic chords. And so I went back at some time, and Walter said, "Oh, no, this is good enough. You play so." I played guitar, but I didn't like it. I really didn't like it because it was something that was forced on me. And you know, when you're an adolescent like that, and I was, you know, about 18 years old by now, you just didn't want to do it. You did it in order to get through school. So I decided to keep my head up in the band and make sense. I started learning to arrange. And sure enough, I took to that like duck to soup, or whatever, the water, whatever you want to call it. And I became an arranger. So I started writing stuff for the vocalists in the bands and specialty stuff for the instruments, and I really caught on. Now, I wasn't going to ever be one of the great arrangers because it's the same piano player. Jimmy was he was talented. To show that he went on to become accompanist for Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan and Nita O'Day, and he also has 2 albums on which he wrote the whole albums with the Duke Ellington Orchestra. So he became, and he wound up his career as a freelance arranger in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. He died a few years ago, mm-hmm. and he had been sick. He had a collapsed lung, a lot of things. But Jimmy was, you've seen those kind. When he came to college, he had been to a little junior college in Chicago, Wilson Junior College. When he came to college, about 20 years old, he was as good as he was the last time I heard him with Ella Fitzgerald at the Guthrie Theater. Mm. You know, just one of those fabulous people who knew it, but very modest, never very shy. And there are lots of guys I've heard about in jazz since that time who never had the great names, but could play. And that was it. I kind of stumbled around through. But the senior year, Walter left. Well, he really didn't leave, but he started doing a lot of concertizing, and he started doing some work at the Caramu House in Cleveland, which was Jeffers. I always can't remember that name. Set up a community center in Cleveland, Ohio, mm-hmm. and he went there and spent a year. And he also started doing some concertizing. In fact, he got tied up with some singers. His first major concert was in Fergus Falls. He showed at a congregational church in Perkins Falls. Yeah.
Just an aside for the record, Walter Anderson eventually became the the chief person in charge of the music advisory council for the National Endowment for the Arts, became a major figure in U.S.
Yeah, Bob Hansen
music.
Has met him, J. Robert Hansen, inducted a lot of people. In fact, he was very instrumental in getting some money through Anderson to get Bill O'Taylor here the first time. And anyhow, he was a very good musician, very well trained out of Oberlin, and a good performer. But he was very honest with us. You know, you're going to have to learn to play when you leave here. And we have gotten you started. But that was everybody else, the sociology professors. You're going to have to go to learn more. We can get you. Well, you know what Kentucky State was like. We get you started, but you've got to go on. And I always appreciated that honesty. Mm-hmm. And but by this time, I was hooked. I really liked music. So my senior year, I did mostly arranging and copying and stuff like this. And got my grades up for graduation and on and on. And that was about the end of my active music life, because now the war clouds. I graduated in 1942, so nothing much happened until I was discharged from the Army in 1946.
You didn't do music in the Army, really.
That was tough.
Yeah.
That was another depressing period for me.
Yeah.
I was stationed at Tuskegee, Alabama for 2 years for much of that. I spent 2 years in training. And I went to some good places like Fort Malvern. Even if I had wanted to, there would have been no time to do it because I was trying to survive in school. This was my first opportunity to get into integrated study, and I really, you have to understand this.
I wanted to prove yourself.
That's it.
Yeah.
And so I gave up music. But then Shawfield, Sumter, South Carolina. And this was in the Air Force in those days. It was the United States Army Air Corps, is what they called it. They had service units. And they, after all this training I had at Fort Monmouth and in electronics and all this, you went through some of this, you know, so you remember that. But I went on farther than you did and everything.
Yeah.
And got very much into this and was very good at it. But I was in the service outfit, and these kids shine shoes and the PX, and they made up beds at the officers, BOQ they called it, and things like this, and there was no place for me. So the commander also knew that in a little black outfit, and so he made me the recreation director. So one day they're going to have a morale parade, and they wanted everybody to learn a song when they go through the parade. So there was a guy there working in the orderly room who was a little bit something of a poet and a writer. So we got there and wrote a march. He wrote the words, and I wrote the music. And I said, let's not do this a cappella. They got a band that's going to be standing there playing this. Let's send them this arrangement down to the band, and they can play for us. Send it down, and the band, the warrant officer called back, and they said, who wrote this arrangement? He said, none of our guys admit to writing it. Who wrote it for you? He forgot the trio. Trio. I'd never heard of a trio. But anyhow, he saw me and said, well, send that guy down there. The commander also told me who it was. I sent him down there. So I went down there, and He said, my God, do you realize I got people here from Curtis, from Juilliard, from New England? I've got musicians coming out of my ears down here in this little band. They can really play, and not a single one of them can write a note. He said, here you are. He says, now, I'm going to send you to warrant officer school if you want to go. I'd do anything to get out of here. And I said, but I must be honest with you. I can't play. What do you mean you can't play? So then he put a couple things. He said, you really can't, can you? You know, I really couldn't sight read. I really couldn't do that. Is that a year? I could do that a year. But he said, all your parts and the right transpose key for the instruments, even down to the tuba, things like this. So he just said, well, can't you get together some? So he suggested that I pick up a little trumpet somewhere and everything, and maybe in a year I could learn to play trumpet. Well, another thing he would try to get me. I said, I just don't want to stay here long enough. I think I'm going to get a chance to get out. So I did. I finally got a chance to get out, and they sent me to Tuskegee Army Airfield, which they sent a lot of people like me because they didn't know what to do with it. Tuskegee was built, it was loaded with talented people. I was, for the first time in my life, a real also-ran. You know, and I wasn't that bad. I mean, I haven't finished college. I had a degree. I mean, this is about 44 now, I think. That wasn't a bad thing to be in those days. I mean, there weren't that many people, black or white, you know, who had these kinds of things. I could do a little music. I was reading. I wasn't well-read, but, I was no pig, you know.
But the Army just didn't know what to do with people. They didn't have the structure. It was still black and white.
It was loaded with talented people. I met people who have made some great contributions since that time, and they were just right there doing it. You know, the Army band was 28-piece regulated band. We had a 156-piece band. And they didn't know. We had many more people out there that could, for example, you know, somebody like me could have played cymbals or bass drum or something, you know, that you know how they put on. No, there was no place for people like that. There were too many percussionists fighting for cymbal positions and glockenspiel and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I didn't even bother. And then they had a dance band, you know, jazz band, and these guys all had come out of Jimmy Lunsford, Erskine Hawkins, things like this. You know? And so, you know, where was I going to play? So I was there for about 2 years, and towards the end, when they started discharging people, then I started getting some little jobs at the NCO club or the Officers Club.
Sure.
But it was a hostile environment musically, because they said, well, you're not a musician.
You're not
a musician.
Yeah.
And that was about it.
Of course,
and
the community itself is a hostile environment, too. Located out there.
But then if you get within a hostile community, and you're not a top dog in that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So, several of us joined together. We had a guy who had been in Hampton Institute, and he was in special service, Lieutenant Williams, James Williams, who had studied under R. Nathaniel Dett. And
it's a familiar name. One of the early black composers.
Oh, yeah, he was very, very, very instrumental in developing a music program at Hampton Institute. And they had a lot of those guys like this. I can't remember the guy's name at Tuskegee, but he also had a good choir. We didn't have instrumental programs in the black schools those days. We had Dawson, William Dawson.
And a lot of his arrangements are still being used.
Yeah, And I used to go to Vespers every Sunday night at Tuskegee just to hear that. Just to hear that choir, and on and on. So Williams organized a little choir, 24 of us, and we had a little choir. Well, I don't have a glee club is what it was. I don't have a good voice, but I can sing on pitch. There were guys there with fabulous voices, couldn't hear up and down. So Williams said, now you get in there and sing loud enough so that you can keep them on pitch and know what it is. And after we'd been in there about 6-7 months, I wrote about 3 arrangements for that group. I always remember my first arrangement was All Through the Night, Sleep My Child, Peaceful Tending.
Welsh tune.
Yeah, huh? And so that was great. I said, okay, maybe you can be an arranger. And I did that. And then discharge day and stuff like this. Well, they gave you $200, I think. Wasn't that what we got? $200 when we got discharged, something like this.
Something like that.
Wasn't much.
Not too much, I know that, yeah.
And I went home, and some folks said, what are we going to do? I really don't know what to do. It was in February, and I knew that eventually I'd like to go to school, but I don't know what I want to take and what I'll do. And I spent a lot of the last year talking to lots of people in various fields. I knew that I wasn't going to become a sociologist, and 4 years later, you know, I'd forgotten a lot of that stuff and everything. So I was looking at library science, journalism, I thought I'd like to write. Just anything that was different that anybody could go into with any kind of good degree, but not just... And I really seriously thought of library science. I think. But because of my work in Signal Corps, and I worked all during that time in the Signal Corps, control tower maintenance and operation, and learned some math, a few things like this. I applied to a few schools. Purdue was one of the major schools that wrote me back, and I even talked to a guy on the telephone. He says, your math background is so weak. I want to go into physics, you see. And I said, guys, we'd like to take you, but you'd have to do 3 years undergraduate, and we couldn't take you in the graduate program in physics. And I had been to undergraduate school, and I didn't want to do it, so I just... So a guy, the same guy who started a little band in high school, C.B. Williams, the drummer, had known a friend in the Navy band. All these guys went to the Navy. That was another mistake I made. I should have gone to the Navy instead of the Army, but... they all went to places and played music for the whole 4 years. He had a little job, got a little job with a friend down in Nashville, Tennessee, in a little joint called Downbeat Club. And they said, we need a piano player. Would you like to go? And $65 a week, 10 at night to 4 in the morning, 7 days a week, and a matinee on Sunday. Finally, later, $65 was about what musicians made in bands.
Yeah.
In the 40s. 46. And so from April of 46 to February of 47, I worked in Nashville, Tennessee. But I took my $200 and bought a guitar. Turned out later, it's a good guitar. Well, $200 was a good instrument in 46. But I still couldn't bring myself around to really work in a place, so I just strummed around. I tried to find a couple of people in Nashville to teach me, but it's that black and white thing, you know, and the white guys wouldn't teach you, you know. But I met a little guy named Pete Hunt. Pete Hunt was playing in another place called Zanzibar, and played saxophone. Pete was a first-class arranger, really knew what he was doing, and was a accomplished. But Pete was like a lot of these black guys, you know. He didn't have any hope, didn't have any dream.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic, you know. And that's kind of bothered me all my life too. I met a lot of people who just weren't going to go anywhere, but good musicians. Well, Pete and said, "Oh, you know, you're a musician, good musician. You understand this stuff. I'm going to show you some stuff about arranging." He did, and we started doing some freelance arrangements. And so one day, he got a bright idea. Let's go down to WSM with some arrangements and see if they'd be interested. WSM, you know, it was Grand Ole Opry and all that. But they also had, you know, in those days, the stations had studio bands and stuff. So we went down and talked to this guy. He says, well, bring me something in and see what you can do. Can you write for strings? And Pete was one of those guys. Oh, yeah, we can write for anything. I never forget this. One trumpet, four trombones, four reeds, five strings, and four rhythm. The five strings are two first violins, a second violin, viola, cello.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'd never written for strings. I went to the music store, and I picked up a little book, and I picked this up simply because the guys at Oberlin, they taught at Oberlin, He, Cox, and Lehman. I'll never forget that little book, and it was orchestration. I went home on the weekend, read that book, did every exercise in the book, carried an arrangement, and it worked. Pete was not quick with the words as I was, so I taught him all the exercise and everything, and taught him that his worked. So the guy said, "Oh, good." And gave us $25 a piece for the arrangement. Well, I was disappointed. I thought he was taking advantage of us and not giving us more money. Tough, right? That's what you got in those days.
Yeah,
the glamour, the romantic aspect, all this stuff. I thought musicians made big money and did big things. Oh. Hell no. He says, well, that's what I picked guys in the band, you know, and they are better arrangers than you guys are. But this Owen Bradley was his name, Owen Bradley, and he said, you know, I want to encourage you guys, and that sort of thing. So we wrote for quite a while. I wrote several arrangements. Some of them were played on NBC. They broadcast everything. The arrangement had to be able to play it down first time.
Yeah.
He said, we don't have studio time. We don't have money for rehearsals. And these are crack studio musicians. First time I've been around anybody like this. Those guys played it down the first time as if it was a Jimmy Dorsey, Tommy Dorsey, Bob Crosby kind of band. They were fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Owen Bradley later on became a great name. I guess he's a millionaire now. And when the whole recording industry really picked up in Nashville, he had his own studio and was a real mogul. He recorded Chet Atkins and Perry Como and all these kind of people. You know, he's a great name. And then he had a brother named Jack Bradley. Well, we finally asked him the great question one day, how can we get on this staff? We'll be willing to work up as Pete and I. We'll work as copyists, and we'll damn near sweep the floor with anything. So he says, okay, let's see how far it goes. This is Nashville, Tennessee, 1947. This guy, at least he was willing to give us a listen. So he went to see a guy named Beasley Smith, who was the music director for the station. By this time, they had TV and everything. And I said, no, he says, we aren't ready to integrate this yet. And so we didn't make it. And no place to go. And I just couldn't see the rest of my life.
Kicking around, just trying
Bill, it was a crooked business.
Scratch your way.
Oh, it was crooked. And I'm not going to let you think I was in a little goody two-shoes there and not know what was going on. I knew exactly what was going on. But I said, do I want to spend the rest of my life in this atmosphere, gambling, illegal drugs, all this kind of stuff, prostitution. It was just, that was the tough area we dealt with. And all these people were coming in, and I would see the chief of police and the lieutenants coming on Saturday night, getting that rake off and pee off. You know, you saw all those kind of things. And I said, you know, coming up under the meth. And I, get me wrong, I'm no great saint, you know, about this whole religious thing. But I did have a background that said, this is not where you belong. And one of a friend of mine that talked about going into counseling and that sort of thing. So in February, I gave up and went to New York in February. Well, I knew I wasn't going to New York, and I didn't. You know, played a few parts and everything. I got one job the whole 3 years I lived in New York, and that was because a friend of my landlady's was sick and couldn't play one night. And I played in a little restaurant on Madison Avenue, and I got $10.
Mm-hmm.
I think I played about 6 hours,
but
at $10. But that was about what I did. But I heard a lot of music.
Yeah.
I went to the Met one night. Only come in, went to the Met once. I was so far back up, I really, really could hardly see the stage. I remember James Melton was singing that night or something. And the only reason I can appreciate that, he was singing in English, and I don't even know the opera. But they started the New York City Opera Company, and so you could get seats for $1.50 in there. So I started, you know, I saw operas. I went to see Toscanini direct, because you could get free tickets because they were broadcasting.
Studio.
Stuff. I decided, well, if I go to New York, and I'm on GI Bill, I have no money. I finally got a little job, but I said, I'm going to do everything I can that I couldn't do back in Louisville. So I went to the Apollo Theater and the Lowell's Theater and the Paramount, and I saw all the great men. I just had a fantastic life there. By this time, my friend Jimmy Jones was there. I went by to see him. By this time, I had written some tunes. He said, I'm not going to be able to help you. He said, he was playing with Sarah Vaughan by this time. He says, you'd be surprised. I can't even get my own music through here. The managers, the bookers. He said, this is a tough business. And I've heard this ever since, of course, and I've met some of these people now.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine came through with Count Basie. King Cole was on the bill at Bop City, and I went down to try to take some stuff to King Cole. He said, I'm sorry. He says, I don't get to choose my material. He said, Duke Ellington's about the only person who gets to choose his material for recording. So Capitol tells me what to record and things like that. Said, you notice I don't even write. I had a chance to talk to King Cole. I was meeting these guys, just, you know, and it was the Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker, all these people on 52nd Street in those days. I saw that. It didn't mean much to me. My landlady, who had been in Lou Leslie's Blackbirds, and they had traveled, it was kind of like the Ziegfeld of the little black world, things like that. She introduced me to a lot of people, but I was just naive, silly little guy. I didn't understand this. And later, when I came here to Morris State, I kicked myself when we started talking about black studies, multicultural studies, and I said, I was there.
Yeah. The Harlem Renaissance.
Oh, I met Langston Hughes. I met all those people.
Yeah.
Through my landlady, you see. She knew all this stuff. She had been a paid soloist in Adam Clayton Powell's church, Abyssinia Baptist Church choir and everything. She knew her way around, that sort of thing. But it didn't click. I was just too simple to know what was going on.
There's no reason why you'd have that kind of background to be able to really.
So I lost out in music. I hung on peripherally. I taught it at what is now called University of Maryland, East Shore. I taught that a year. Got fired. So I got fired by my old buddy who used to be dean at Kentucky State. He said, no, you're not ready for this. You're going back to school. And so then I went to Florida A&M. Same problem there. Just great musicians. Well, you know, the great Cannonball Adderley came out of Florida A&M and a lot of guys like that. I had to be honest. I wasn't in that league. But I got to do some arranging. I do some playing. I did things at a secondary, tertiary level. And I enjoyed it. But I knew by then I was hooked. You know, this was going to be, you know, I didn't hunt, I didn't fish, I didn't smoke, and all this stuff. Music was it. And so anything I could do was music. So I finally took up a guitar again and started strumming some chords and things like this. And then things just didn't work out for me in Florida and him. And this time, the 1954 Supreme Court decision, and I didn't think the South was ever going to do right. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was something. I didn't have a doctorate and everything. So I met a guy who also was in music, a psychologist who used to play up in this area. It come from Grand Forks. His name was Anders Sweetland. Found out later his sister was a nurse out to the VA hospital, but nobody seems to know much about Anders except in Grand Forks. But he played in a lot of bands. I bet Jimmy Dunn, a lot of things like that. And so I went to the University of North Dakota for a year, and then it all turned around again. I was a big shot. And I played down to the Bronze Boot, and I played at the Riviera, and I was, that's how I got to, you know, I played every Friday and Saturday night the whole time I was in Grand Forks. I only stayed a year.
Oh, there's piano still?
Piano. Mm-hmm. Piano still. Mm-hmm. Did some writing, had a little show with a student out of Barnesville, Lynn, can't think, Lynn Nelson, and we had a little show, Kaleidoscope, on KFJN, the radio station up there, and just, I was a star. After coming from New York, Florida, Louisville, Nashville, all of a sudden here I am a star. You know what I mean.
Well, a little local, smaller puddle, and you have to be a lot bigger frog.
And then I looked like I was going to get a doctorate out there, and somebody advised that, and it was race. It's purely race, you know, and it was experimental psychology, and of course, you know, nobody was giving doctors to women or to blacks in those days in experimental psychology. It was old boys, white club. My advisor, I go over to Jamestown State Hospital, and I took an internship and really got my credentials high on that one, and got a job. I was offered about five jobs in Minnesota, and the best one offer I took was in Fergus Falls, and this was working with retarded children, and professionally, I think I told you all the time, I grew and learned, and I had all this experience. Wealth of experience with me this time. Mm-hmm. And then one night I was sitting there. Oh, by this time I bought a hi-fi set, you know, mono, you know, and all. I'm on my way up. I'm buying records, collecting records, everything. Mm-hmm. Now. And so I subscribed to it was then called Hi-Fi Stereo Review. No, Hi-Fi Review. Later on, when stereo came in, it's not Hi-Fi Stereo Review. Now it's just Stereo Review. And I found this article in there on the classical guitar. And it was written by, I always remember, a guy named Gene Lees. And he talked about how rare the classical guitar was in the United States, but how big it was in Europe and that sort of thing. And there were a handful of people in the United States that taught it. And one of them was in St. Paul, Minnesota. So I told Yvonne, you know, we ought to go down and talk to this guy. And I went down there and met this little guy, the nicest, sweetest little guy. It was another one of those turning points in your life. Mm-hmm. He had been struggling there since 1920s, teaching all the fretted instruments, mandolin, ukulele, banjo, anything to make a living. Had a little studio, wasn't much bigger than this room, another one bigger than that room, and he sold a guitar. So I bought a little guitar, $200, which was in 1938, not only 38, it's 58 by this time. A good little guitar, or maybe 59, doesn't make a difference, close in there. Came back, and I'd go down once a month on the old Red River train and stay in the St. Paul Hotel and take a lesson and come back. And I was as proud of that as if I were an 8-year-old kid first beginning lessons, and I was going to play a little simple-minded stuff. But the classical guitar turned me around, and it made me interested. By this time, I know what I'm doing. There's a system to the classical guitar. There's no system to the guitar in jazz. Mm-hmm. And I was able to transfer that. I went out and bought a good plectrum guitar. I still have I don't want to say too much because I don't want to. Well, I know where this is going. I have a valuable guitar collection. Mm-hmm. And some of my guitars are worth $2,000 to $3,000 now, which I did not pay for, but I bought them in a time when my teacher and some other people wanted me to have them, and so I really started working at it. I was getting still a few gigs here in Fargo with some of my friends on piano, but then in '65 when I came to Morris State, it turned all around, and I started really getting serious about a guitar. By this time, I had my doctorate out of Nebraska, mm-hmm. So I was pretty secure, earning a nice little living.
Sure.
And then, when was it? Oh, about 1968, somewhere like that. Frank Scott came back to town, and Lois Hansen called me one day and said, "Jim, Frank Scott wants to start a group. Do you know who Frank Scott was?" Luckily, everybody had always talked about Frank Scott, and he had this band at WAY, and he was well-known in the range on the playoff with Lawrence Welk. Well, that wasn't jazz, but by this time I've decided that jazz is out the window. And Frank said, you know, I've tried four guitar players, and none of them know anything. He said, now I'm not going to audition you. You know I've been out in Hollywood, and I play all these kind of guys. I just want to ask you to play me two or three chords. And he asked me if I could play something like a, this was pretty close to what he asked me, like a G7th with an augmented fifth. Mm-hmm. Can you play a D13th? Can you play a G9th with a flatted fifth? And I just, God damn. The other four I tried don't even know what these chords are. You know, These are all the pretty chords. Well, he started a choral society, and I started playing rhythm guitar for him. And Frank almost cried. He says, Jim, if I'd had you years ago, I could have made a great rhythm guitar player out of you. And he started working with me. Well, I found out later, Frank used to play guitar. He always wanted to be a guitar player. Mm. And he still had a tenor guitar. Mm. But he, you know, did so well on piano and his range, and so he never did. But he always, Frank was the first guy I ever met who knew how to write for the guitar so that it sounded like a good rhythm instrument. Well, of course, Frank is a great guy. So I started taking advantage of this, and I started taking lessons from Frank on arranging.
Mm-hmm.
And so for 2 years, I started arranging with Frank, and that was great. And he really did something about it, and little things sort of picked up. And by this time, Ricardo Vissus had come here, and we had fooled around because he found out I played guitar and stuff. And so I said, well, I'm going to take a sabbatical, and I always want to go to Spain because that was something I could afford. I couldn't afford to go to France. I would have preferred to go to France, but I didn't have the money, and Yvonne and I packed up and went over there. So I said, Ricardo, do you have any idea who I could study with over here? Oh, yeah, you could study with the guy who's been accompanying me. And this is this Ballesteros, Tito, mm-hmm. who came here several times. And so I got over there and I started taking a couple lessons. He says, well, next week we'll go down and sign up at a conservatory. Sign up for what? So, you know, everybody studies at conservatory. You don't want to just come over here and study privately. And I, oh, conservatory, I have no business. Santa for what? So, you know, everybody studies at conservatory. You don't want to just come over here and study privately. And I, oh, conservatory, I have no business going to conservatory. Well, it turns out they have a real good program, and they have three levels, something that would be equivalent to our bachelor's, something equivalent to master's, something would be equivalent to our doctor of musical arts. So I went over to conservatory and just passed, and that was just very good, and I took a little my teacher, kind of like Walter Anderson, who told me about theory, also told me, this Albert Belson that I'd studied from in St. Paul, said, you'll never give a concert. You'll never be a good, great player, but you'll do well, and mm. you'll learn enough to teach a lot of things like this. Mm. Well, Tito kind of told me the same thing. He says, you know, it's too late. You know, I was 38 when I took up a classical guitar, but you're an apt learner. You just don't have the facility to learn how to be a great player. Well, I had to ask myself, I wasn't a great piano player. Now I'm not a great guitar player, that sort of thing. Well, but I work at it and study at it, but I've never been, as you know, the 6 hour, 8 hour day practice.
Mm.
And that's what it takes. I've learned what it takes. And I said, so I came back, but I started getting fewer and fewer jobs. Frank left and went back to California again, and then I took a second sabbatical. By this time, this was sad, and I think I've told you the story before, that I was going back to the conservatory, and I was going to finish this little certificate where you were still vice president, and then you remember the story. And I didn't make it, and I'm one course short of that bachelor's degree. Well, it turned out, of course, a lot of politics in those European schools, especially in the conservatories.
Hmm.
Well, Ricardo started offering these tours and everything, and I'll say this on the record because I don't mind. I thought he was taking advantage of our students. And I didn't think it was a very good program. By this time, there were some other people, Mary Ellen and all these people, who, you know, were trying to develop programs. They thought it was good. I thought, you know, we're going to be studying in Spain in 6 weeks, and what we're doing, and it was costing a hell of a lot of money. And I knew our students here. This is the people's university. Our students don't have that much money. I didn't think they were getting that much out of it. And Ricardo, it got back to Ricardo, I said it, and he got mad. And then he and Tito got onto me, and I really didn't flunk that course, that third course. The politics of it, they just eliminated me. And for a long time, I didn't forgive Ricardo. But more than that, I didn't forgive Mary Ellen for propping up it, because it was a program run by a travel agency. Well, this year, I've been vindicated. Ricardo isn't doing the program anymore. The travel agency is throwing him out.
Really?
Uh-huh. And he's taking a tour to Europe as well, just as a tourist group, through France, Italy, all down there, Portugal, Spain. still an old-fashioned hustler. He brought all the worst of the Spanish hustler into the all the worst of the American entrepreneurial system. Mm. Well, that's too bad. Mm. But that's, well, you know what happens sometime in higher education, how we get involved with fails and stuff. But that kind of took me. I always used to think that I might go back to Spain sometime and finish up at one course. And I still might, just for the record, because it doesn't mean anything. Ego, you know.
Sure.
But I make enough money now, and some year I will spend a year in Paris, but that's what I would like to do. Yeah.
Now, tell me about the jazz scene in Fargo Moorhead. Was there any jazz when you came here?
Yeah, there was some jazz. In fact, I would like to think there was more jazz then than there is now.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
You didn't
because I was right on the edge of the beginning of the rock. The beginning of the rock, we try to document it as 1955. Mm-hmm. Well, I came here in 1965. Well, the rock really hadn't hit that hard yet. The Beatles really hadn't taken over. Mm-hmm. So there was jazz at the Legion Club. There was jazz in the Skull Room of the old FM Hotel. There was jazz at the Kale Hotel, which was new then. There the Bowler out here on University Avenue. There were about five places in town where you could play jazz. About three of these, two or three of these, would intersperse with local talent versus, visiting firemen. And
sure.
Like and that were some good players.
Yeah, and these were small combos, basically.
Small groups, no big bands.
No big bands.
No, not until Frank Scott came back did we try a big band, but we didn't get much work even with Frank Scott. Yeah,
no.
That was tragic for Frank, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So these places were having live music weekends and
some of them were good bands. Jim Ployer, who was a very good writer, had the band at the FM Hotel. At the American Legion, every Saturday night.
He still does?
No.
He
did then in those days. And he had six pieces and a singer. And he writes very well, and he wrote this beautiful charge. And every once in a while, I'd go up and sit in. I did a lot of sitting in because I was trying to really get to the guitar then. And I was really getting to learn the rhythm stuff very well. And then, of course, Frank really helped me a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say this in all honesty, with no modesty attached to it. I am now a very excellent rhythm guitar player.
Mm.
I'm not a soloist. And I know by now I'll never be able to be a soloist. But I could join Basie or
those chord changes are right there.
They're right there
when they should be there.
And because of my studies in solfeggio, as you know, and with arranging with Frank and other and the classical guitar and everything, I understand what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. Well, I would understand what I'm doing if I were trying to play concert music, like this, except I just don't have it.
Technique.
Yeah.
Who are some of the other? Jim Ployer, and of course Frank Scott. Who are some of the other figures?
A guy named Don Bolson. Don I met when I.
He's a pianist.
Yeah. But he also plays a nice trumpet.
Oh yeah.
But he didn't really work at it. He was at the North Dakota State Employment Service at Jamestown when I was there.
Now doesn't he play Dixieland?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, he hates it. But he plays it. Well, we're old and that's about all the music we begin to play. None of us like it, but that's what we play. Mm-hmm. Well, he got me a few jobs in Jamestown with little groups out there playing. He had finished, he has a music degree from Jamestown College, and he had played a lot in the military service and stuff like that. He's a good player. He came to town to work at Old DeVos, which is Smith's now, and selling pianos, but that just bored him to death.
Mm-hmm.
So he went back to the state employment service, stayed until he retired. His wife worked for RIS, so they didn't have too many financial problems. So he would send their kids to college, things like this. He's soft sell, low pressure, but he is a terrific player. Mm-hmm. And I can, start to name the people that I've been around with. And I still play with him a lot. And whenever they have if we play outdoors, Republican picnic or country club for the bank, things like this. I play guitar with no piano. I mean, I'm that good now that I can substitute for the piano.
Yeah.
And, of course, with the advent of the electric piano, a lot of those kind of jobs just went down the drain because a lot of guys, jazz guys, don't like to play with electric piano. Plus, I know all the tunes. That started with my high school days.
Sure.
And I've kept up with that. And, of course, my good ear, So anybody who has played a job, like country clubs, I played a country club for a year. With Don, that was another thing I did. Before I went on sabbatical second time, he needed a bass player, and he asked me to buy an electric bass, so I have a little electric bass, a little Fender Mustang, and I played for a year. And so I got my, chops up playing every Saturday night, and some other parties and things like this. So I have a little bass, too, so I can play classical guitar, rhythm guitar, bass, and do the solo stuff, too.
Mm-hmm.
The solfeggio really did help my reading, though.
Oh, yeah.
Single line stuff. I had no more. Well, I won't say I don't have problem. I'm not like a violin or a flute player. But I'm a good reader.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is rare. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I think we've probably covered Jim Condell and the music scene
That's been an interesting
well.
One. Yeah. It's called The Fringe, being on the fringes. That's what
one
it is.
One of the other things you're doing now is doing some research in guitar.
Oh, yeah. And also beginning to get involved in biography. And and I've been writing. I made a contact in 1984 with a guy in Toronto that runs a Coda magazine. So I published about 6 or 7 articles in there now. And I have one coming
These
out.
These are
next
pioneer
month.
Figures in jazz guitar.
Jazz, yeah. And the basic Kenny Burrell, Jay McShane. And I also met Jay McShane, who came here in 68 to play at the FM Hotel. And we just sort of stayed in contact. I don't know why, but we did, you know, the Christmas card type of stuff. And now I'm working with him on his autobiography, collaborating with him. And we hope to submit that to a publisher before too long. Yeah, we've been working on that now for about 5-6 years, and this same publisher of this magazine in Toronto is doing the discography.
Oh,
yeah. So that's the only thing holding it up now. I finished the book, and that is really encouragement. Thanks to the school, I've done some seminars and psychobiography and things like that. And I suppose for the last 15 years, that has been my real area of study: biography, autobiography, psychobiography, things like that.
Yeah.
So I hope to do some real serious writing in that. Norm Botanica, I've been going to his class in human growth and development now for about 3 years, every quarter, and I've been talking about the lifestyle of Duke Ellington based on the lifespan development of Eric Erickson's theory. And we're thinking about trying to turn that into a book. Just a lot of little things are picking up.
Well,
yeah. And I'm going to Oberlin on April the 29th, because one of my little students that I taught here is graduating in music with guitar major in Oberlin.
Is that right? Who is that?
Paul Silberglite. Mm. And I taught him when he was in Ben Franklin and in Fargo Senior High. And Fargo High.
You've had students through the years.
Oh, that has
particularly
that
classical.
That has been sad. Yeah, I have taught several people who play so much better than I do.
Yeah, humbling, huh?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Okay, well, very good. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.